Coming up Sunday morning at 9 on Hometown Heroes, a World War II Navy veteran from Taft remembers landing boats at Saipan.
The Japanese were looking down from the heights of the mountain, and they had already pre-zeroed in a lot of their guns, and so there were shells exploding all around us as we went in.
He made it through that invasion, not to mention Tinian and Iwo Jima, and he came home with some pretty unique souvenirs. The rest of his story, Easter Sunday morning at 9 on 1560 AM and 97.7 FM, KNZR.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show that hopes to illustrate that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have done incredible things and endured at times unbelievable conditions, all for the sake of that freedom that you and I enjoy every day as Americans. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price of freedom. And along the way, we are educated, entertained, and sometimes even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our guest today is 93-year-old Victor Killingsworth of Taft, California, author of the book, The Gator Navy, the amphibious navy that I knew in World War II. I'll let you know a little later how you can get your hands on it. It is one of those rare occasions when I wasn't able to fit a veteran story into one episode. I had to extend it over two programs. So last week, if you missed the show, you can find it at hometownheroesradio.com. But last week, we heard about how Mr. Killingsworth grew up in the small town of Taft. He was studying for finals at the University of California in Berkeley when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. We heard how, once he enlisted in the Navy, a blind date in Virginia led to a marriage that's now at 68 years and counting. And we also heard how he ended up volunteering for dangerous pre-invasion duty at Kwajalein in the Marshall Islands. We left off with Mr. Killingsworth ready to lead landing boats into Saipan in June of 1944. So let's pick up the story right there.
We got into Saipan that morning on the LS2, worked our way up through the ships. There are hundreds and hundreds of ships. The island was afire, smoking, burning. Our battleships had been pounding for days, our cruisers and destroyers, and then we even had gunships that were firing 20 millimeter shells in close. We pulled in there and put our boats in the water and got ready for the landing operation. And as we were getting ready, the cruiser Indianapolis pulled right in the beach where we were supposed to go in, and I thought, this is a disaster. How are we going to get past the ship? And we had never trained to split the wave and go around them. So I took a chance and signaled for the boys to split the wave and go around. And they did. We went on front and aft of the Annapolis and then came back together in front of it. And she fired over our heads while we were going in. I could see these 8-inch shells, 10-inch, whatever they were. They're slow. Their velocity is slow. You can actually see them, you know, going in to the beach ahead of us.
I don't think you ever saw any of those in Taft, did you?
No, I didn't see any of those in Taft. And, of course, the Japanese were looking down from the heights of the mountain, and they had already pre-zeroed in a lot of their guns. And so there were shells exploding all around us as we went in. And I remember, I mentioned in the book, a big 12-inch piece of shrapnel going over the top of our boat, going through the air like that. And I lost two boats going in. I had the first wave that went into the beach, and then the other five waves came in behind me. And we always had an officer in the front and an officer in the back of the wave picking up. So my officer that was behind me, his job was to pick any survivors up. But I think one of the most emotional things that I ever experienced was as we were going in, we were almost to the coral reef. I couldn't, in a landing boat, I couldn't go over the coral reef. So I was to make sure the tractors were on site in the right place, and my job was to turn around once I got them there. So As I was turning around, the Japanese hit two of my tractors as they climbed up on a coral reef. But there was a Marine torpedo bomber who was doing something way beyond the call of duty. It wasn't his place. He didn't have to be there. But he flew right down the coral reef right in front of me. And his gunners were strafing the beach. And the gunner in the back stopped long enough. He turned around and he waved to the troops. And about that time, a Japanese shell hit the plane, flipped over it, flipped on its back, and disappeared into the ocean. And they brought the bodies up a few days later. But just that split second, just as he was waving, he was shot down.
And again, that you just said, that crew didn't need to be there, but they were there to try to support you guys. So it was their lives instead of yours.
Yeah, it was, again, it was beyond the call of duty.
All your stories in your book are so vivid. Some of them run together. Was it Saipan where you also described that the Japanese guns were centered in on a spot in the water right next to you?
This is true. After my initial landing, my job was to go back to control boat where my commanding officer was to see if there were further orders. So since I finished, I went back. As I pulled up alongside the boat, he said, Vic, he said, the Marines are already calling for water and more ammunition and medical supplies. Can you take three boats and go in? I said, sure can. So there was a Marine officer on the control boat that was communicating with the Marines. And he said, I'm going too. And he jumped in my boat with me. And so we took off. And the first one the 27th, I think, was Marine Regiment also was a backup. They weren't supposed to land in the initial landing, but the casualties were so heavy, they had to bring them in. And so they had their Buffalo's tractors. So we found one of those, and I told the guy, I said, we need to go into the beach. I need to use your Buffalo. He said, sir, I can't do that. He said, my ramp is not working right. So I said, okay. So we went on. We found another one. Again, it was an Army Buffalo. He said, my battery's low. And this Marine colonel said, I'm going to kill SOB. And he started getting his gun out of the holster. And I said, no, let's move on. We'll find a Marine. So we found a Marine alligator. And we pulled up alongside. This kid came out of the driver's side all by himself. There was no crew in there except this one kid. Blood was running down his face. Apparently he had been shot across the forehead. And blood was running down his face. And he said, I didn't steal it, sir, he said to the Marine officer. I didn't steal it, sir. He said, my guys need help. So he went with us. We found two other Marine alligators, so we took them out to the supply ship, and we put medical supplies in one, water in one, and ammunition in the other. And we started back in the beach, and we went to a slot in the coral reef, which had never been tested because the Japanese had owned the islands for 30, 40, 50 years, I don't know how long, and they would never let an American on the island, and they published nothing. So we had no idea how deep the water was when we went through there. So I went through this reef with these three tractors to a Japanese pier that was about 3 or 4 feet above waterline, and I pulled alongside. I told them that we couldn't go in the beach because the beach was just, the Japanese were dropping artillery on it. Just, it was horrible. I knew every time a shell hit, men were being killed or wounded. It was that bad. So I told them to throw the stuff on the dock, and they did. They started throwing the stuff on the dock, and the Japanese snipers started shooting at us, and the bullets were pinging off of the tractors. So I said, we got to get out of here. So they unloaded, and we started back, out through the slot. And my commander was sitting in this opening with a long pole, trying to find out how deep it was, to find out what size boats we could pull through there. And I started waving at him, telling him to turn and get the heck out of there. And finally, at the last minute, he finally figured out what I was doing, and he turned around and left. And I had sent the tractors through because they were slower. And then I came in behind him, and I don't think I was 100 yards through that slot until the Japanese artillery, which they had zeroed in on it apparently before, but their communications was terrible. They were terrible. So apparently they just got the word to fire. So when I look back, the water looked like somebody had taken an egg beater and beat the water. It was just so many shells coming in. It was just foamy. If we'd been in there, we wouldn't have made it. But we got through there without any trouble.
So if your commander hadn't moved out of the way and you were still stuck there, you wouldn't be talking to me right now.
That's right. If he had just stayed there and he'd have plugged up the channel because it wasn't very big for us to get through. Yeah.
How many of those close calls like that did you have? Because it seems like there were quite a few.
Oh, I not many, I don't think.
Do you need your toes to count them?
Like I say, I had nothing but respect for the Marines. My job was so much easier than theirs. I thought they were the boys I needed the hats off to.
Thing was, you kept volunteering to do more than just your job, as is evident from reading your book, The Gator Navy. And another thing I read in there with interest, because I've talked to a lot of guys who are on Saipan, a lot of them have discussed how disgusting and disturbing it was to them that so many civilians took their own lives there, jumping off that cliff because they'd been told lies about what Americans might do to them. And in your book, there's a pretty similar story there where you actually came upon some civilians who were contemplating that.
Well, after we moved on the beach, I left the ship and became part of the boat pool that was on the island. My friend Sid Cohen and I decided that we would go visit this commander that we had met on the LST and see if he made it. So we went over to Marine headquarters, and sure enough, he was there. And he said, the Japanese surrendered. He said, getting ready to go up the island. You want to go with us? We said, sure. And he said, what kind of a gun do you got? Well, we had our pistols and our holster. He said, those pea shooters that you're carrying, you need a man's gun. So went over to area where the Marines had behind the lines, where if a Marine were killed or wounded, they'd pick up his gun and bring it back to this place, and they would cannibalize these guns and put the guns together so that they had spare guns. So he had told this guy, pick out a couple of good guns for these swabbies. And so he gave us a couple of M1s. And so we got the truck with him and took off, went across the island and then up the other side. And about two-thirds of the way, three-quarters of the way up on the other side, we ran into some Marines. And there was a Marine major there. So we pulled the truck over, and the colonel wanted to know what was going on. There was a group of Marines in a circle and had a little boy about 10, 12 years old, and they were just talking to him, and the kid was crying, and it was a mess. And the colonel started chewing on the major, what are you doing to this boy? And so we found out that this boy had come up and told the major there was some Japanese who wanted to surrender in a cave down by the water. So he'd sent a patrol down with this boy. When he got down, the Japanese ambushed and killed the whole patrol. So the Marines' buddies were not happy with this boy that had led them into this ambush. But they had some prisoners there, some civilians, and he said, you guys, would you take them with you to the prison camp? So the colonel volunteered us. So Sid and I had to get on the back of the truck with our M1s, and they put the prisoners in this truck, and we took off and went up around the end of the island. It was like a Western, something you'd see out of a Western movie. There were Japanese dead behind rocks, hanging over rocks, behind buildings. Some of them had tied themselves up in palm trees, and they'd been shot out of the palm trees. They were hanging like dolls on the end of a string blowing in the wind. And we went around the end of the island, started down the other side, and all of a sudden we ran into a lot of Japanese civilians again. So the Japanese that we had in the truck started hollering and yelling in Japanese that we couldn't understand what it was. So we pulled over, and all these Japanese started running and jumping in the truck. They were packed in like sardines in there. And that was where they were jumping off the cliff, right there. They were jumping off this cliff, and to mothers and children holding hands and jumping in the water, killing themselves. They had been told that the Marines would kill them all, rape the women, and kill it. So they had no idea. But the Japanese in the truck that we had apparently saved lives by telling them we were okay, don't jump. I know what they were saying, but anyway, when we pulled in, they all just swarmed into the truck. So we took all we could, and little did we know that that was the place where they were jumping in the publicity we'd get in later years. But as we started on down the road, we finally came to a Marine roadblock. And the Marine came out, held his head up, and he came up to Colonel. He says, "Where in the so-and-so did you come from?" And the Colonel says, "We came around the island." He said, "Don't you know that Japanese haven't surrendered yet?" He said, "Well, I'd been told they'd surrendered." He says, "No, they haven't surrendered yet." So we went behind the Jap lines all the way through them. I think the only thing that saved us the fact we had those Japanese civilians on the truck, and they were amazed at what are these guys doing here? Nobody ever fired a shot at us. So finally, well, it was about 4 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, we got the official notice that the Japanese had surrendered.
So you didn't know you were saving their lives, and they didn't know they were saving your lives.
That's right. It was a mutual thing.
Isn't that something? Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories over the years, but I don't know too many situations where that kind of odd paradox existed. It's time for a break now on Hometown Heroes, but when we come back, we'll follow 93-year-old Victor Killingsworth from Saipan to Tinian. We'll relive some more close calls and maybe chuckle a little bit, too. I think you'll appreciate the creative nickname Vic and his Navy buddies had for one of the Pacific's top generals. And have you ever heard of a foxhole in the bottom of a boat? Right back with more of Victor Killingsworth's story when Hometown Heroes continues next after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting again with 93-year-old Victor Killingsworth of Taft, California. If you missed the first half of his story last week, you can find that podcast online at hometownheroesradio.com. When we left off, he had shared some of the close calls he experienced on Saipan, concluding with the way that he and some other Americans ended up saving some civilian inhabitants of Saipan from those suicide cliffs of Marpi Point, an infamous spot where thousands took their lives because of Japanese propaganda promising mistreatment by Allied conquerors. You heard Mr. Killingsworth also confirm that he believes those civilians may have saved his life and the lives of other American soldiers and sailors there with him, because they were unknowingly behind enemy lines, and the presence of those civilians may have prevented hidden Japanese forces from firing upon them.
You know, I know I'm bouncing around here, but you talked about the thing that led up to that, where there was that deception and the ambush, and of course, the Pacific was famous for the booby traps that the Japanese had everywhere. And you actually had an instance where you were near the commanding general of your forces who almost got taken out by a booby trap. Where was that?
Well, when after they had mopped up Saipan, they had to take Tinian. It was 3 miles away. And again, I volunteered to take troops over there. So I had 75 landing boats. We loaded them on the beach at Saipan, and we went across 3 miles of open ocean water to land on two tiny little beaches on Tinian, which the Japanese did not think anyone would ever try to land on, because normally it takes, 400 yards of beach to unload, to land a division. We had one beach that was 50 yards, the other one's 100 yards. So they were very tiny. We left Saipan, and I had these boats all strung out behind me, and we had made a feint at Tinian Harbor, and we had sent the amphibious ships there, and they fiddled around. We put some boats in the water. The Japanese pulled everything out to Tinian Harbor, thinking that was the ideal place to land, because it had a big white beach, beautiful place to land, and they thought we would do that. So they had left the area where we were going exposed. But when by the time they found out about it, they sent their tanks back to defend it. So they were coming on a road above the beach, and they started firing at us with the tanks. Well, all of a sudden, my landing boat was heading out to sea. I got down behind the steel plate, too. And I thought, where in the world are we going? I looked up, and my coxswain was sitting on the floor of the landing boat with his hands up like this, and he was steering the thing. And I thought, wow, I better. So I got my head up, and all 75 of my boats are going out to sea. And I told the coxswain, stand up where you can see what you're doing. And I had in my boat, I had the commander of the Marine Forces and a Jeep with a trailer. And the Jeep trailer was full of mortar ammunition. So as we were going, one of the shells from the Japanese tanks hit right beside my landing boat, and the water went up in the air because the water keeps it from going sideways. So I went up, and the water came down all on top of my boat. And the boat group commander come crawling out from under the Jeep, and I was sitting there laughing. And I was thinking, if that shell hit this boat, we'd just be a grease spot, you know, because we had all that mortar ammunition. So I was laughing, not at him, but thinking about the situation. But he thought I was laughing at him. So he told me, he said, the next time a shell comes that close, I'm going to dig a foxhole right in the middle of your boat. I never will forget that.
That would be a first. Yeah. And didn't you tell me a moment ago you didn't have any close calls? Yeah, likely story. And then General Holland Smith, who you use his affectionate nickname liberally in your book, tell us what that is.
Well, once we got settled there and we built our base at Tinian Town, General Howland Mad Smith and his group came ashore.
That's Howland Mad. Holland was his real name. You guys called him Howland Mad?
Yeah, because he was out loud. He knew what he wanted all that. But anyway, he came ashore with two guards with Thompson submachine guns at their hip, and then his aides and so on. It was a group of about six or eight walking down the Jap pier right next to our camp. And one of his aides went down and, hey, look what I got. And he picked up a booby trap, and it went off. And fortunately, he just got shrapnel in his ear. So it was an easy way to win a Purple Heart, but he was fortunate he and the general didn't get killed.
And we did have generals killed under similar circumstances in the Pacific. I know we're running short on time. I don't want to leave out Iwo Jima, because everybody has seen the iconic image that Joe Rosenthal snapped atop Mount Suribachi. But you saw it from a little different perspective. You weren't quite as close up, but you saw that same Stars and Stripes. How did that all unfold?
Well, after I left Tinian and went back to Pearl, I was reassigned to USS Artemis, AK-21, an attack cargo ship, as a assistant communications officer. So when we went to Iwo Jima, we had reserve units. We had reserved heavy equipment, and we had about 300 reserve Marines. Well, again, that battle was so tough. That was the toughest battle the Marine Corps says they've ever been in. They took the 300 men off the first day. And some of the equipment they began to take off as they could, and the captain of our ship moved up as close as he could get to get this equipment off. So we were fairly close to Mount Suribachi, and I was on the bridge came over the radio that the Marines had just taken Mount Suribachi and placed the American flag on there. So I ran the wing of the bridge with my binoculars, and I was able to see the second flag being hoisted out Iwo Jima.
Yeah, and folks who have read up on it or have listened to this program faithfully over the years are aware what you mean when you say the second flag. I'm guessing, though, that there are quite a few out there listening today who say, wait a second, second flag? I only know the one flag I've seen in that photograph, which, of course, has been everywhere over the last 70 years and, of course, is captured in 3D form in the beautiful statue at the Marine Corps Memorial outside Arlington National Cemetery. So let's go through a brief synopsis before I get back to your feelings about seeing that flag up there.
The first flag atop Mount Suribachi went up a little before 10:30 in the morning on February 23, 1945. A 40-man combat patrol had been sent to take the high ground, handed a flag from the transport ship USS Missoula, and told to put that flag up if indeed they took Suribachi. So once they reached that summit, they put the flag on a pipe and hoisted it up. They even had a photographer there to take a picture. It really wasn't that big of a flag, just a small red, white, and blue speck from the shore below. But James Forrestal, the Secretary of the Navy, was so moved by seeing it up there that he decided he wanted it as a souvenir. Of course, the Marines who took the hill weren't very happy about that, so Marine Colonel Chandler Johnson sent a crew of his guys to get that flag and replace it with a bigger one. It was that second bigger flag that Joe Rosenthal turned into perhaps the most famous photograph of all time. There were two other Marine Corps photographers up there with him. The one who took the color film, moving pictures of that flag raising, maybe you've seen that, Bill Janost was his name. He would later be killed in action. And of the six men pictured in the famous photo, three of them would die on Iwo Jima. The story has so many twists and turns. There are some great books about it. And of course, that movie that Clint Eastwood produced in recent years, Flags of Our Fathers, covers a lot of ground. Anyway, that's why you said the second flag. But when you saw it, what did that mean to you to see Old Glory up on that high ground in a battle that claimed the lives of over 6,800 Americans?
Well, it was very inspiring and sobering, a very sobering thing to think about. We didn't know how bad the battle was at that particular time, but I knew, I was thankful that I hadn't been in landing boats because when they tried to land at Iwo Jima, it was in black volcanic sand. And it was about 10 foot high from the water line to the top of the bank. And as the Marines tried to walk up that, it was like walking in sand. They could slip back. It was very difficult to get up off the beach. And then they tried to put tanks in there, and they got bogged down. And it was absolute disaster. Landing boats were upside down, turned over. Tanks were in the water. It was an absolute mess trying to get on the beach there at Iwo.
And you had done that job at previous landings, so you knew what it was all about. And you said you didn't know how bad the battle was. It actually got worse after they put the flag atop Mount Suribachi. A lot of people forget. Anything else about Iwo Jima, anything that you saw or experienced there that stands out for you?
Well, the captain, as I said, tried to get in as close as he could to unload the equipment, and he got a little too close because the Japanese set up a mortar on the beach, on a cliff right near us, and fired a mortar round. I was on the bridge when it hit in front of the ship, and the captain was on the bridge also, scared him to death. He ordered full steam up reverse, and he put the ship. Fortunately, we had steam up. We were underway, so it was easy for him. And we started backing up, and as we backed up, the Japanese kept firing, and they kept hitting in front of us. So fortunately, they never did hit our ship, but I thought that was unique that mortar rounds could be fired from the beach at a ship. We were too close.
Definitely too close in that instance. I tell you, I'm not trying to put thoughts in your head. I'm interested in your take on it, but I hear all these stories, and it sure seems like somebody was looking out for you. What do you think when you look back at all those situations? Do you feel like you were experiencing some kind of protection there?
Well, I knew my wife was praying for me. She
wasn't your wife yet.
Oh, my girlfriend. She was a strong Christian, and she told me she was. And I'm sure my mother and others had a lot to do with my safe return.
Did you ever think that you weren't going to come back?
No, never did think that. But that's training again. You know, when you're trained up to do a job, you have confidence. That's the only way you can win. You got to have confidence. You got to have the feeling you're going to succeed, and we were trained to that.
What do you think is the most frightened or unnerved or just scared that you ever were?
Well, I really hadn't thought about it like that. I was always concerned, you know, that this is kind of a tight spot we're in here, but I don't remember being afraid or scared. Like you say, it's all in the training. It's in the training.
Well, obviously well-trained. Where were you when the war ended?
When the war ended, we were coming back. After Iwo Jima, we went back to the States, took on port director units, and they sent us back to Japan. We were one of the first ships in Tokyo Bay. We were exploding mines as we went in. So that's how early we were going in there.
So it was on the way there that you heard.
And then, so we put port director units in Yokohama and some of the northern Hokkaido, some of the northern islands. And then we were sent home. And about 2 or 3 days out of San Francisco, I was a communication officer on the ship. And about 2 days out of San Francisco, I was decoding a top secret message, and it said, "Lieutenant Killingsworth, you are hereby ordered to report to Naval Base, 12th Naval Base in San Francisco." So when the ship came in, I was loaded and ready to take off, and couldn't wait to get to a telephone to call my girlfriend and say, "Let's get married."
But you waited a long time. I mean, I think you saw her, what, January 1st, was it?
Yeah. No, I got into San Francisco on the 10th of December, and she came out from Virginia with her mother, and we were married January 5th.
You hadn't seen her for 2.5 years, but you'd been writing these letters, and you hadn't asked her to marry you until you were back.
I think we had an understanding, pretty much, yeah. She and I, but that was a big deal when I got back, yeah.
Because I think in your book you say on New Year's Eve you had your first date in 2.5 years, and then on January 5th you got married.
That's right. It was fast, you know. War does strange things, doesn't it?
And they say if it's fast, it's not going to last. But 68 years later, I guess you've proved otherwise.
Yeah, it's been a short 68 years.
What do you think's the secret to the success of your marriage?
Keep your mouth shut.
Pretty simple advice, but oh, so hard to follow sometimes, isn't it? Victor Killingsworth of Taft, California, our guest today, and we're not done yet. When we come back, we'll hear about some of the unique souvenirs he brought home from his Navy service in World War II, what he saw that convinced him the atomic bomb saved his life, and we'll also hear about the genesis of his book, The Gator Navy. If you'd like to get your hands on that book, which is part of the library at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, you can call Mr. Killingsworth at his home in Taft. Here's his number, 661-765-2360. Again, that's area code 661-765-2360. I have that number posted along with his email address on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and at hometownheroesradio.com. Back with the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor. From now through the end of April, Sleep Retreat is closing out three of the most popular models of Tempur-Pedic mattresses. This is a limited-time offer and a chance to save up to $2,000 on the best-selling Tempur-Pedic Rhapsody, Cloud Supreme, and Contour Select models. When these models are gone, this sale is over. So don't wait. Call the store and reserve your Tempur-Pedic closeout model and save up to $2,000 today. Sleep Retreat is part of the Fashion family of furniture stores, so you know you'll get the best possible customer service. Sleep Retreat on El Paso. So just steps from the main store.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping up a conversation that has spanned two episodes with Victor Killingsworth, 93 years young, of Taft, California. If you've been through Taft in the last few years, I'm guessing you couldn't help but notice the largest bronze statue in all of California It's that Taft Oil Worker Monument, a memorial to those who pioneered the industry, which remains the driver of the economy in Taft and all of Kern County, really. Mr. Killingsworth spearheaded the effort to fund and construct that memorial, produced by a Taft native named Benjamin Victor. It's definitely a must-see if you find yourself near Taft. And Mr. Killingsworth's book, A Gator Navy, I'd say is a must-read. But the memories recorded in that book aren't the only things that came home with you from World War II.
You have quite a few souvenirs that you brought back. And I wanted to ask you about one, because you write in the book about seeing plans for the invasion of Japan. Are you one who believes that if the atomic bombs had not been dropped, that you wouldn't be here?
I'm convinced of it. When I was in Japan, Buddy and I got a car. Being an officer, they would furnish us a car. Civilians drove them. It was their car. They would sign up with the Army to rent their car and themselves out as a driver. So we got one of these cars, and this guy took us to the, because I knew where we were going to land, because I had seen the landing plan as a communication officer. I was in charge of top secret documents, and we had picked up the landing plan in Manila. And so I knew where we were going to land. So we went there, and I was able to see that area. And I told my buddy, I said, if we'd tried to land here, we'd have lost 1 million men. And 50 years later, they released the official figures, and it was in Newsweek. Yeah. And the generals had estimated 1 million men.
And what was it that you saw? Was it just where the guns would have been? And
well, it was in an area where there was a lot of ridges and mounds and so on. So when we went there that day, we saw a Japanese, not a pillbox, but a place where they guard house. So we got out, went to see what it was all about. And this mountain was like an ice cream cone turned upside down. And we were able to go inside the mountain that scooped out the inside. And it had a pathway. It went up this thing, spiraled up to the top, and every 50 feet or so, they had a machine gun pit. And in that walkway, they had wooden floorboards. I pulled those up, and underneath there was food. There was everything to stay there for a long period of time. And knowing the tenaciousness of the Japanese, they would have held on there. I mean, we would have had to go through one after another, just like at Iwo Jima. They had the crossfire. It was so intense. We lost more Marines, more casualties than any place else. And going into Japan itself would have been hell.
Well, I guess then it's a good thing that you guys secured Tinian so the B-29 could take off there and drop those bombs. And I imagine you probably had high esteem for President Truman.
Yes, yes. Well, I felt it was horrible what they had to do to Japan. But in the long run, it saved millions of lives, I'm convinced.
On both sides, for sure. Speaking of, there are a lot of things that you brought back from the war. I don't have time to talk about all of them, but one of them that's certainly eye-catching and is fascinating to feel, too, is the silk flag. It's big enough that you can roll it up and tie it around your waist, and that's exactly what the Japanese soldiers did. It's got the rising sun in the middle and then a lot of Japanese characters written on there. What's the story of how you came back with that flag?
Well, I traded a bottle of bourbon for it. We after things had settled down at Tinian, we had a liquor lounge, and I was not a big drinker at the time. And one of the Marines had this battle flag, and he wanted a bottle of bourbon, and so we made a deal. So I got the flag, and he got the bottle. Probably the bourbon's gone by now, but I still got the flag.
You have a lot of other souvenirs, too. You have knives, clubs. You have one of those bolo knives the Chamorros used in the Philippines. And this little piece right here is something I can't say I've ever seen before. It's pretty fascinating. There's a wooden structure around it, a glass top, and some Japanese writing on the little metal label that's screwed on. What is this thing that looks like some kind of futuristic spaceship or something?
This is very unique. I don't think you'll find any of these anywhere else. This was from a two-man Japanese submarine. When we went into Yokohama Harbor, my buddy and I were out exploring and went to this Japanese naval base, and they had about six of these subs in construction inside of dry dock. And the workers must have been their lunchtime or something. They're all sitting around in a circle smoking opium. They had a pipe they were passing around, so they weren't paying attention to us. So we went up there. He said I was crazy. I said, I'm going to go inside one of those two-man subs. He said, you're nuts. I said, no, I want to see what they look like. So I went inside the hatch and got down in there, and the workers had left some pliers and tin snips and things there they'd been working. So I said, you know, nobody ever believe I was at a two-man Japanese submarine. So I took the tin snips and cut off the dome light. This was a dome light in a two-man Jap submarine, and brought it home with me so I could prove I was in a Japanese.
And it's very well preserved, and I'll put a picture of it on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll also see a picture of it in his book, The Gator Navy, some other fascinating photos as well. As we wrap this up, a few more questions for you. How many kids and grandkids and great-grandkids do you have?
Well, I have three beautiful, wonderful daughters, and then I have five grandchildren. I have four boys and one girl, and I always told my granddaughter I have four ugly grandsons and one beautiful granddaughter, so she likes that. And now I have four great-grandchildren, aged from 16 to 2 months, and there's two boys and two girls. So we have four great-grandchildren.
Well, by my count, then, that's a dozen people who wouldn't be here if you didn't survive all those close calls. Is that kind of eye-opening to think about it that way?
It is, and we have a very close family, and I think about that every time we get together, how unique it was for me to be able to find my love in Virginia and me in California, and to be able to, only a war would do those things.
It did all happen as a result of the war. God has some funny plans for us sometimes, and you ended up back in Taft. You had a sporting goods store there, Taft Sporting Goods, for many, many years. What do you love about your hometown? Because you grew up there and you're still there.
Well, when I came back from the service, Mr. Blackman, I told you about earlier, had offered me a job with Associated Oil Company, and he did offer me a job, but my wife liked Taft. She was away from her family. She came from a big family. So she felt good when she was around my family, around people. They, most of them, lived in Taft at that time. So she said, I'd rather stay in Taft. I'd offered a job in Ventura as a personnel manager for Associated, but she wanted to stay in Taft. So we did. We bought a sporting goods store that had been started just a few months before. And for 38 years, there's only 3 years I did less business. For 35, I was always growing, and it kept my interest. I always thought about moving and leaving, and we looked at places, different parts of the country, but the business held her interest, and made a lot of good friends at Taft, a small town. And if we had to do it over again, I'd do it the same way. I could be home in 5 minutes, and I could be, you know, at the football game in 5 minutes, and so I like that.
Can't take that for granted. And in the book, folks will even see that you ran into one of your old Taft College buddies during the war. I'll save that story for those who read the book. And speaking of the book, it was Peggy that twisted your arm, told you you needed to write this?
Yes. I guess I bored her silly for years, recounting the stories, and finally she said, you know, you need to write a book for your family, for your grandkids, so they will know a little bit about the war and know a little bit about family history. So it was at her prodding, and I didn't think I could do it till I retired. So when I had retired, I had the time.
And you had a little gentle prodding from your wife, Peggy. Let me slide over to Peggy to get this side of the story. Let me see if I have this right, Peggy. And the undercurrent to all of this is that you and Victor wouldn't have met in World War II if not for what happened to your father in World War I. And there were times that you wished you'd had a written account of your father's experiences. He fought for the British during World War I and came back with shrapnel in his elbow. And that's what led to your family coming to the United States? Do I have that right about how it all happened with your father?
After the war, he went home to get a job, and no one would hire him because he was injured in the war. So that's when my mother and father decided to come to this country. And that's how it all started. And the thing about it, we children had heard the story so much, and it was kind of boring, and we wouldn't pay any attention to it, you know. And Victor was telling the grandchildren all about it. And I told him, I think you should write a book. and put all of that information, because I didn't write a book. I didn't know too much about what my father really went through. Yeah. So that's what, that's how it all got started.
Well, good job, Peggy. And Vic, good job to you. You know, I've read a ton of World War II books, and yours is really very well done, thorough, vivid. It makes you feel like you're living those adventures that you experienced. So great job, and I hope a lot of people pick it up. The one last thing I wanted to ask you about before we close this up was Honor Flight, because Kern County Honor Flight took you to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial. We heard about all those close calls. We heard you told us a story I'm thinking of now of that torpedo bomber where the guy waved to you and then they went down. And then you go to that memorial and see all those gold stars representing 400,000 Americans who didn't come home.
What was that experience like for you? What did you get out of that journey with Honor Flight Kern County?
It was very sobering again, and it was a wonderful experience. I think every veteran should try to go. I don't know of anything that the country could do that was better than that, really. I noticed, there's an Atlantic part of the memorial and a Pacific part of the memorial. And I noticed they have battles there described like in the Pacific. I was amazed at three or four of the battles they had there I had been in. And I saw other gentlemen there that were telling their buddies they're looking, and they were choked up in tears.
Yeah. And I know you experienced that too, and I know you're feeling it right now. I just want to say in closing, thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for writing this phenomenal book to help us understand what it was like. Is there anything else I didn't ask you about that you want us to know?
No, I think you covered it pretty well. They have my book at Annapolis, and as part of the Navy archives, and they ordered a second one. Good. And so it will be part of naval history, and that makes me feel very proud.
Well, you should be. Quite a lot to be proud of. Victor Killingsworth, 93 years old. He's going to be 94 on Veterans Day. So if you happen to find yourself in Taft, California come November 11th, make sure you track him down and say happy birthday. I'm sure you're also going to want to thank him for serving our country and for writing such an informative and entertaining book about the Gator Navy during World War II. On the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a video of Vic with one of those souvenirs you heard him discussing. You'll see him demonstrate how a Japanese soldier would have tied his silk Rising Sun flag around his waist. Next time on Hometown Heroes, we're going to hear from another Navy man, the first Navy SEAL to ever rise to the rank of Admiral. I'll look forward to sharing his story with you. And one final note for today's program, you've heard me talk about EECU and its sponsorship of this program, enabling me to provide CD copies for all the veterans who appear on Hometown Heroes. But I also want to recognize EECU, that is Educational Employees Credit Union, for its outstanding support of Honor Flight. Through a recent campaign donating money from every auto loan in the month of March, EECU raised $18,750 for Central Valley Honor Flight. That's enough to send more than a dozen World War II veterans to their memorial in Washington, D.C. So thank you again, EECU. And thanks again to KNZR in Bakersfield, our Hometown Heroes affiliate in Kern County, for allowing me to record this interview with Mr. Killingsworth there. We're out of time for now. Until next time, I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.